Okay, very good. So for this evening's talk, there was an interesting suggestion which somebody sent to me, and it gives a little subject to try and spin a talk around of spirituality and just meaning and helping one's life get better. And the subject of the talk was space. So be prepared to space out for this talk. As we talk not just about outer space, but inner space too. But we'll start with the outer space. And I remember from when I used to watch TV 40 years ago, Star Trek, The Final Frontier. And as I like to say, to boldly go where no monk has gone before. If I remember correctly, it's to boldly go where no man has gone before. So I say to boldly go where no monk has gone before. Because as a monk, I like to get sort of new ideas, new subjects for talks, and just to explore them. And to start off with space, because many of you know that before I was a monk, I was a theoretical physicist. And one of my great joys was astrophysics, exploring the meaning of space and outer space and finding actually what it really is. And it was brilliant to actually allow your head to be taken apart by all these theorems which people wrote on the blackboard in the universities, actually to start to see things in totally different ways. And some of those ways you learn to see things expanded your awareness, and it had consequences, you know, in your daily life. So it's not just theories, it's not just mental just gymnastics just for the sake of it. It was actually quite powerful what it meant. And one of the first little meanings, and I've said this about over a month ago, but I love saying this again, was about the meaning of space having no boundaries to it. Boundless space. But what that really meant to me was, as a young man, I do recall just thinking about the space and how far does it go? Is it infinite or does it have edges to it? And if it has an edge, is it a wall? Is it a fence? Is it just a place where you go further and you fall off? And if you fall off, where do you fall into? Because you can't fall into space, because that space has ended. And for me, it was never very clear how you could have an end to space, and also how it can't be infinite either. And what I learned in science, in theoretical physics, if you haven't heard before, that this space, this universe in which we live, it is limited. It's only got a limited size. It doesn't go on forever. But it's got no edges to it, no boundaries. And how that was explained to me, and there's consequences to this little anecdote, as you'll find out in a few minutes, as it was explained to me, it was like an ant crawling over a basketball. And I would say a football if I was in Europe or UK, but over here, footballs are just, AFL balls or rugby balls, and they're not round. But imagine like the round ball, like a basketball. And an ant crawling on the surface goes round and round and round and round and round and round, and notices it's a finite area, but it hasn't got any edges to it. And that was the description given to me at Cambridge about the nature of this universe, the nature of space. It is curved. You go far enough and you actually come back to where you began. Just like the ant goes round the ball and eventually retraces where it was before. But it's got no edges to it. Space is curved. Limited size, but no boundaries. And of course, we know that we always thought the Earth was flat before, until we realized we've got our heads around the fact that it's round and it's a ball. So it's got no edges to it, but it's limited area. And that's the same as space. But where I made the next step was to time. Just like space having no edges but being finite. Time is the same. It has no edges, no beginnings, no ends. I know when people thought the earth was flat, it has beginnings and ends. If you sail far enough, you'll fall off. And that's what people think about time. There is an end of time when everything finishes. And more interestingly, there's a beginning of time, the first edge, before which there was no time. And the answer is that's not a satisfying idea. Time with an edge means it has to be a God, there has to be a Big Bang, creator, first of all stuff. Why should there be? And the best solution, instead of being a flat timer, which is what most people are these days, like flat earthers, we are a bent time. So time goes round and round. No beginning, no end. And that starts to solve a lot of the problems of religion and also philosophy. So that's where we start from. But then also, as well as outer space, you know, we go to the inner space at all. Because, yeah, sure, if you ever see any photos or videos of what it's like when you get outside the atmosphere, there's nothing there. But we always thought, well, we come back home. And we come and sit on solid ground. Solid ground, ha ha ha. That is just an illusion. You've all seen in the science program that what you're sitting here, concrete, is just a bunch of atoms. And those atoms are so far apart that there's so much space between the atoms that it's 99.999999999. It goes on a long way, space. And the atom is just a tiny little thing compared to the space between it. So even on this planet Earth, even on what you're sitting, there's nothing there. It's mostly space. And if you go inside the atom, you know, the old ways of looking at the atom, electrons and the nucleus, and the nucleus is so tiny. It's, even in one atom, it's 99.999999 and goes on, absolutely nothing. And then you go inside a proton, and it's just a few quarks. There's nothing there. It's 99.999999% nothing. In fact, even solid stuff is mostly space. And that really sort of freaks me out when I think, the only reason I'm standing up here or sitting and not falling through is just this play of forces, but actually there's nothing really there at all. Total space. But as human beings, we forgot to really notice space. We notice things instead. And that's one of our mistakes of perception. So, whenever you get into a room, what do you notice when you come into this room? Maybe the Buddha statue behind me, who's the monk giving the talk today, a few friends outside, the carpet, the walls. But how many of you, instead of looking at the things in the room, look at the space between us? And the space in this room is far bigger than all the people and the things. And sometimes we say, oh, this room is full. It's not full. There's heaps and heaps of space. And if you go with someone who observes space rather than things, it gives you a different perspective on life. And also you can use that even to your financial advantage in your work. For example, you know I travel around a lot. I've just come back on New Year's Eve from traveling over to Singapore and Malaysia. And I've often noticed how much space is wasted in the aircraft. And I can make this wonderful idea for any person who wants to start a new airline, which can double the capacity simply by asking people to sit cross-legged on the floor instead of seats. And in a normal aircraft, you can get two levels if people sit on the floor. There's so much space wasted around their heads. You can put, like you're doing now, you can put sort of, you know, in just 2 meters, you can put two rows of people if you sit cross-legged. So on my airline, Buddha Air, there will be no seats. Everyone would just be sitting on the floor, cross-legged. Maybe we'll give you a free cushion if you're in, and a bigger cushion for business class, but small cushions for economy class. But that way you can get twice as many people in the aircraft, and it means it's cheaper and you get more profit. So what a wonderful thing. And that's when you start noticing space. And also, why is it? Now, you really shouldn't do that, because space is beautiful, to give space between people. Have you noticed that sometimes if you're too close to someone, you feel really cramped? Why can't we have more space in our life? The trouble is we're afraid of space. So much so that I look in your houses, which I visit from time to time, and how much junk have you got in your house? If instead of looking at things, you look at space, how much space have you got in your house? And don't think, oh, I've got a space on that wall. I need to buy something to stick on it. There's a corner there. I've got to buy something to stick in the corner. I've got a free room. I've got to put something in it. Why is it that people hate space? And they always want to put things in it. Why is it when people go into the wilderness, they go up a mountain? What's the first thing you do when you go up on top of a mountain? Put a stupid flag on the top, spoiling it. And the flag is only the first thing they put on top of a mountain. Give them a few more years, and there's a restaurant on top of the mountain. Why can't you leave the mountain free, beautiful empty space, instead of thinking, there's an empty place, I've got to put something in it? Why is it we cannot revere and cherish space? Simply because we are materialists. We've been conditioned and trained to notice things and to value things and to get more things. And that's why our world gets so full and jammed and packed, and it's terrible. We can't move because there's not enough space, because we don't value space. So it's incredible when we change our perceptions and then we get open areas. We say, this is full of space, so we can't fit anything else in there. This room, he said, what's there? This is my space room. And keep it like that. Number one, the more spacious your room is, I don't mean you're spacious your house. People say spacious houses, they just mean big houses. They're still as cluttered as anything else. You go into my house. Many of you have visited my house, my cave. And there's nothing in there. It's, people say, you know, where's your stuff? I say, what do you mean? My cave is full of space. That's why I love it to meditate, because I value the space. I value the emptiness. And imagine, this is one of my old huts. Years and years and years ago, there was this women's group, you know, every Wednesday afternoon, nothing much to do. And then they would just, you know, retired or semi-retired, and they'd have a club and go and visit interesting or weird places. And I think our monastery came under the second category when they organized a visit. So, yeah, I mean, just this was quite a few years ago. Buddhist monks, this is weird, you know, what they're up to, what do they do, and all sorts of stuff. So it was an interesting afternoon out for the girls. And so I took them around, and I remember taking them inside my hut to have a look around. I said, is this it? Is this where you live and sleep? It's only about 3 meters by 2.4, the old huts we used to live in. And they looked around, there was nothing there. No TV, no radio, no cooker, no bed, sleep on the floor. And they said, is this all where you live? I said, yeah, this is it. I said, wow, if only I lived in a place like this, they said, I would get my housework done in half an hour. And they were really jealous. Because how much does it take to clean up your houses? And you've got two big houses. They're not spacious, they're cluttered. Imagine you get rid of things, how quickly it is to clean it up. And so it's nice and free and empty and spacious. That's a real spacious, not the size of your house, but the amount of space you have in there compared to the amount of things. So maybe I should actually start, also my other idea for a new business, you know, for a new like Myers store where we only sell space. So you can get a couple of meters for a couple of $100 and just put the space in your house, freedom. Now, when we value that space, what we're actually valuing is actually freedom. Because when things get cluttered, we lose our freedoms. And we're not just talking now about space, physical space, like the space in your schedules, the time you have. How much space do you have in your weekly schedule? Or is it all just full up with things to do, places to go, jobs to finish off, things to fix? And sometimes we don't give our daily schedule enough space because we don't value that. Space is not important. Space is something you've got to fill up. What are you doing for the holiday period? Nothing. Oh, come over here, go over there, fill up your space. This is supposed to be your holiday time, a time for rest. Many people are going to go back to work on Monday morning, 2 weeks over the Christmas, New Year, more tired than when they left work. They're exhausted. I don't know why that is. People say, I can't wait to get back to work, I'm so tired. Some people say that. So one of the reasons why is because we don't value the space, the emptiness, the freedom which space gives us. So, just like you can value space in your house, space between houses, space in our cities. You know the spaces in the cities, the gardens and the parks, they are so incredibly important for our well-being. It's just a place we can just open up. We haven't got the walls around us. We can actually be free. I recall actually going to the old Fremantle Jail. I've been here for over 30 years now. And over the first year here, I went to go and give some teachings in the old Fremantle Jail when the prisoners were still there. I remember one of the things I noticed about going in that jail, the walls were so high, you could never see far distances. You had to look up really high to see the sky. And so all these men inside this jail have spent years just seeing walls in front of them, never seeing space, never seeing the horizon, never being able to have this incredible privilege which you take for granted to go up onto a hill and just see forever, see space all around you. Now there's something which is really important to be able to do that. So even if people were in a prison, if I designed a prison, I wouldn't like to do one. I'd actually put a tower in the prison so prisoners can go up and see the sunsets or the dawns. At least get close to something which is incredibly therapeutic and natural and freeing. Yeah, they may be in a jail because they've done some crimes, but certainly they should not be to have the idea of space and freedom taken away from them totally. And prisoners complained about that, and I thought, you know, how incredibly perceptive you guys are. You realize the seeing just no space, no freedom, no horizons was just a torture which should be against human rights. But anyway, just you have that opportunity to see great distances. Do you take advantage of it? Do you get out of your house? Do you get on top of the house and just, you know, see just the great distances? They always say that when you have houses on top of hills, they're worth much more. And that's also why we build monasteries on top of hills and mountains. You can see the great space around you. It's so refreshing. And sometimes, in big cities which are all closed up, or in airports where you can't see very far and it's all plastic and unnatural, there's something which is very unhealthy about that and causes people to be sick emotionally and physically in society. Just going out where there's lots of space. So many emotional problems. You have a sense of freedom all around you. The world is not encumbered anymore. You know, you can go wherever you want in any direction. There's space you can see in any direction. And there's nothing in between cluttering up your vision or even your cluttering up your imagination, the ability of your mind to soar at great distances. That's so important spiritually. And of course we need that in our time as well. Just like our cities become very cluttered, so our schedules become very cluttered. So it's up to you to grab those spaces, give them importance. And so the parks and the gardens in your time, in your day, the places where you can just hang out and do nothing are so important. sometimes I feel a bit of a fake teaching meditation because all I'm teaching you is how to do nothing. And it's the most difficult thing people can do. And that's why meditation retreats, people say, give me something to do. Just, no, I won't. Just meditate. No, but how do you do meditation? You don't do meditation, stupid. You just don't do anything. But, I need something to do. And isn't it strange that what should be the most simple of all things for a human being to do, to find space in their minds, space in time, space just to hang out and be, not cluttered, not having things to do, not having objects in the mind like you have objects in your house. So you can go freely through, you know, this 30 minutes of meditation, no encumbrances, nothing to bang up again, nothing to trip over, just totally through because there's nothing there. That is just the meaning of space. And when one values space, and this is the key to it, value it, give it importance, cherish it. It's more important than things. Because when you actually think of space between people, the space between you and your lover, that's where the relationship happens. Sometimes we think it's his fault, sometimes we think it's her fault. It's not his fault, it's not her fault. All the problems don't exist in that partner, they don't exist in yourself. They exist in the space between the two of you. And sometimes, you know, with counselling people having trouble with living with another person, that becomes a focus on not your partner, not, you know, yourself, but what's going on between the two of you. Even actually visualize a space between you and your, you know, lover, your partner. What's happening in there? What are you putting in that space? Because what you put in that space, that's the affects your relationship. 100%, totally. And a lot of times we put, say, fear in that space. We actually choose to put fear in that space. You know, fear what she's going to say, what he's going to do, fear whether it's going to happen. Whatever you put in that space affects the way you look at that person. Sometimes you put suspicion. I've seen this happen so many times in marriages after a few years. The husband comes home late and you think, oh my goodness, he's coming home late, he must be having an affair. He's not having an affair, there's lots of work on at the office. You know, trust the guy. You know, the wife is like dressing up really nicely, she must be having a sort of a partner on the side. She's not, you know, she's just, you know, becoming a bit more self-confident, experimenting with her, you know, looks or her hair or whatever. But why is it we're so suspicious of one another? We put actually suspicion in the middle of our relationships. And that causes a huge amount of problems for us. And even actually relationship to ourself. Again, sometimes we put just so much negativity in that relation, that space between the relationship of ourselves. And in order to change that, you know, some of my old little tricks and techniques, I told it to someone just beforehand, that's why it's in the front of my mind, and I just tell this to so many people, telling in Malaysia, in Penang, in Singapore, such a simple way to put some fun and silliness in a space between you and the other person, especially you and yourself. And I do that a lot of time. I'm a really silly monk sometimes, messing around, putting fun between things. And so the one which I've been teaching people is actually get up early in the morning, do your 10 push-ups. And as soon as I say 10 push-ups, is that a New Year's resolution to lose weight or something? It's not a New Year's resolution to lose weight. I do my 10 push-ups every morning. I haven't lost weight yet. But I have a lot of fun. And the 10 push-ups, if you haven't heard them before, in the morning you get up, you go into your bathroom, stand in front of your mirror, get out your two fingers, and push up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It works in front of a mirror. Just by you looking at me doing something stupid like that, straight away you're putting a bit of stupidity between you and the image of you in the mirror. And what a beautiful way to start the day. Why are people so serious in life? There's enough to be serious about, but put a bit of space of fun and joy. Remember that Patch Adams guy who just is a mess around like hell in the hospital, and so many people got better. They tried to get rid of him and sack him for, you know, not being what a doctor is supposed to be. What's a doctor supposed to be anyway? But he was doing it differently and had so much joy and fun, joie de vivre, doing stupid things. He actually increased the cure rate in the hospitals just by putting a bit of fun between him and the patients. Of course, really serious stuff. I mean, if someone's dying of cancer, they're really sick. You know that, I love telling this my story. There was a Tibetan Buddhist nun here many years ago, and there weren't that many monks and nuns around. We don't care what tradition you are, we're all Buddhists, and so we'll look after one another. And so she was in the hospice. You know that old hospice they had in Shenton Park, which they closed down? That was a crime to close that place down, but nevertheless, what can you do? So I went to visit her one day because she called me from monastery in Serpentine. It's about an hour and a quarter, hour and a half to that place. She called me, the word came through that she said, look, I'm dying. Can you come and visit me before I die? And this has happened to me a lot of time. In my job, you know, you're really close to death because, you know, you just go and visit people all the time who are dying and do funerals and stuff. So many times I've noticed this. This is anecdotally. You may have the same experience. When a person says they're going to die in a day or two, they always do it. You know, they're sick. The doctors can't say, but they know, yeah, I'm on the way out. Another day or two, and I'm going to die. And they always get it right. And so this is what this lady said. So when she said she was going to die in a day or two, you know, I realized, no, you know, she's not making this up. She's going to go, so I better go and visit her quickly. So I went all the way from Serpentine to Shenton Park, dropped everything I was doing, and all the building stuff and other stuff I was supposed to do, because this was important. Arrived at the Shenton Park Hospice and had to check in with the nurse, first of all. And the nurse was this middle-aged to aged Irish nurse. And she was, you know, I described her as the Margaret Thatcher of nursehood. Because she was just one character. Because when I went up to her and asked her, I said, look, what room is this nun in? And she said, no, you can't go and see her. I said, but no, I've come all the way from Serpentine, an hour and a quarter just to see her. I don't care how far you've come, we must respect our patient's wishes, mustn't we? And she was really fierce at me. But you know, you think I'm soft, I can stand up for myself. And I said, she just called me a few minutes ago. She asked me to come here. And she got really upset at me. She glared at me and she said, come with me. And so I followed her. And we went to the door of this patient's little room. And sure enough, you know, there was a notice on it. And the notice said, absolutely no visitors. And the nurse looked at me and she said, see? And there was a notice up there, absolutely no visitors. But I looked closely. You know what it said on the bottom? Except Ajahn Brahm. And a Buddhist should not do this, but I couldn't resist. See? She deserved it. But I should have been more compassionate and kind. And she just went off in a huff. And that was one of my memorable moments, getting my own back. But then, of course, went in the door. When I went in the door, the first thing I said, when she welcomed me, I said, why did you put that notice on there? Now, why did you say absolutely no visitors except for me? And she told me, and this is important for you, she said, when I have all these visitors and they see me, you know, I'm had riddled with cancer, only got a day and a half, 2 days to go, and look at me. And she did look like a skin and bones, gaunt, not the person you knew 6 months ago. And she said, everybody who comes in to see me gets so depressed and they get so upset seeing me like this 1 or 2 days from death. And when they get so depressed and they start crying, that makes me feel bad. I'm bad enough as it is. I don't need everybody else's emotional baggage put on me. And he said, Ajahn Brahm, you're the only monk, only person who comes into this room who doesn't get upset and instead tells me jokes. So, another joke, please. And that's what I did for about an hour or two, just, shared jokes. She was laughing. Because she wanted to be treated as a person. And I was the only one who could do that, instead of someone dying, someone sick. People just saw her body. I saw something much more than that, much more valuable than that, because I put respect between me and her, and see deeper than the sickness. How many times when you see a person, just you see their sickness, and you don't see the person? It's much more than the sickness. So we can do that. And she valued that so much. Now, I treated her as if I was just treating a person, you know, with a, going to have a cup of coffee with them in the afternoon. I refused to see her sickness. I refused to see the fact that she was going to die, because everyone else was seeing that, and she knew that. She wanted to see something bigger in her. So, you know, between the space between us, I could have this beautiful relationship. You know, putting, taking away the fear, taking away the negativity, taking away the disappointment, and putting something positive. And I often teach people that if you want a relationship with anybody, you know, have a look at what you put between you and that person. Because that's what you look through to that person. Fear, anger, you know, this is my enemy, so you put anger between you. And you look through that anger and you see all the faults in the person. Of course you will do that. Every now and again you do this automatically. You know, someone you really like and care for, maybe your mother visits from England, or a really best friend you haven't seen for a while and they come for New Year's or Christmas time. And you have so much fun spending time with them because you put love between you and that person. And that's what you see, and that's what they show you back. You know, I've done that a lot with visiting people in prison. I like talking about prison experiences simply because these are extremes. People have done some terrible, terrible things in their life. And when I sort of go to the prison, I always put just, actually I put respect between me and that prisoner. So I can see things in them which are wonderful and good and beautiful and kind. And I see that through the respect which I put between me in that space between people. And when they come back to me, it passes through respect and I see the beautiful part of them. It has an incredible, powerful effect, you know, on just connecting with a person, because what I see in them, they see in themselves, and what they see in themselves grows. And amazing just how they really get on and don't go back to prison again. Remember dear old Nick, he was in prison. And I was teaching him meditation. Now, he was a drug dealer. And after a while, sort of, you know, he left the prison, went straight. And I remember seeing him in the airport, just waiting for someone in the airport. I spend lots of time in airports, as you gather. I was sitting in the airport, and just somebody put their hand on my shoulder, turned around, and it was Nick. And he said, "Hi, Brahm." You know, he called me Brahm, not Ajahn Brahm, because, you know, these are sort of not Buddhists, but just people who really respect you. "Hi, Brahm." And he had this big smile on his face. "I still meditate every day," he said. And it's so cute, you know, that you'd actually help somebody and they were still doing the right thing. Simply because you learn the relationships exist in the space between people. So just actually changing perceptions and seeing spaces rather than people. Seeing the space between things in your house rather than the things in your house. Seeing this hall, you know, that actually I designed this hall, believe it or not. A architect just drew it up. It's basically my design. And I wanted to just make it full of space and have very few things. Unfortunately, the altar behind started off really, really simple. But people don't like space. They keep putting things on there. And they're not worshipping the Buddha. They're worshipping things. Have you been to any of these temples or churches? We've got so much stuff on it. And sometimes people in our modern world, they get upset at that, rightly so. Why are you wasting all this money on stuff when what the church or the temple or the monastery is really teaching you is space, emptiness, freedom. The first year over at Bodhinyana Monastery, you had some visitors. And I remember this experience. They came along and I saw them. So, "Oh, you know, you got a new monastery, Buddhist monastery, fantastic." I said, "Where's the monastery?" "So, what do you mean, where is the monastery?" "It's here, you're in it, you're standing in it." But they had this idea of a monastery as a building. They wanted to see some big structure, you know, maybe like you see in Thailand, or some big structure like a cathedral or something. "Where's the monastery?" Said, "This is the monastery. The space is the monastery, not the things inside of it." And this is actually gives you a different perspective. What is, I always like saying this, what is a church? You know actually the meaning of the word church, if you look in the English dictionary, you find the etymology, was the people. The church was just a gathering of human beings. And after a while, because they gathered in a building, you know, to protect themselves from the weather and the rain and the cold and the snow and stuff, the meaning of the word church was transferred to the building. And now we have buildings, but no church anymore. The people have gone. It's fascinating, isn't it? Because we forgot the meanings. So space is the most important part of spirituality. And once we've focused on the space, because the space is not just what's between us. It doesn't just separate us, but actually the space connects us. I remember doing a little ceremony for a... You know, this conference we're doing next August, it's a whole series of conferences, and when they launched one in Singapore, they invited me to go up for the launch and to make something for the papers, some event. You know, we got on a boat and got into the straits, and we did a little ceremony of just throwing some, I forget what it was, some holy water, some flowers, you know, into the straits. And this would go to every part of the world on the currents of the oceans. And we're saying that just the water actually doesn't separate the countries. The water actually connects us. We can look upon the space as two ways. We can look upon the space as what separates us or what surrounds us, embraces us and connects us. Just you change your perception. The distance between you is not what separates but connects us. And looking at that space in that different way, you can look all the space in this room is actually connects us, embraces us, enfolds us and keeps us safe. So we don't have to be afraid of space if we change our perception of it. It can be something very beautiful and lovely. The spaces between, say, me and, say, for example, just think of my brother in England, a long way away. But that space doesn't separate us. That connects us. That's the thread between us, which may get stretched but will never disappear. The space is very beautiful. And even when somebody dies, and they're not in the house anymore, but their space is still there. It connects us. You know they're not gone. No, there's been an imprint there in space. And that imprint, just like in, I don't know if any of you have ever studied homeopathy. I got very into homeopathy when I was in Thailand, simply because there was no other medicine. The doctors were too far away. You had to just, look after yourselves. And if any got bit by a snake or a scorpion or hit your toe, there's nobody to ask to help you. There's no ambulances. You had to look after yourself. And so somebody suggested homeopathy. I really got into it. And I had personal experiences, great experiences, where it worked for me. So anyway, that was where you sort of take something and you take some sort of poison, you add it to water or alcohol, shake it up, and then you dilute it and dilute it and dilute it until the chances of even one molecule of that original substance being in the final solution is zero, but it leaves an imprint somewhere. People, things leave an imprint in space. Now that's part of Einstein's general theory of relativity. Just how massive objects leave an imprint in space. Actually, they bend space. That's actually where he explained his law of gravity. That space, it's not being something which has no texture or anything. Space is like a membrane, he called it. You put a massive object on that membrane and it bends the membrane. That's what space is. Space is not something which is unaffected by the people within it. So when you come and live your human life, you leave an imprint in space which is never eradicated. Just like massive objects, and some of you, especially me, are massive objects, we do bend space-time around us. Now, having that idea, you actually leave an imprint in space in the universe. It's actually something quite fascinating to get your head around. You certainly know if that's a family member who's passed away. They don't go. They're dead, they're buried, they're cremated, but they don't go. They leave an imprint in your lives. They certainly leave an imprint in your heart. There's people who never get forgotten. And some of their teachings, some of the experiences you've shared with them, they're there, just like, you know, homeopathy. Just always leaves a trace of the original substance, a footprint. Even though there's no sand for the footprint to be seen in, the footprint's there somewhere. And each one of you will leave a footprint on this world, will leave a footprint amongst the people you've known and lived with and talked with. It's wonderful to know that. The space carries information as well. It carries the information of the people who've lived in that space. Sometimes in indigenous culture, they always think that the land, you know, it carries the imprint of the people who went before them, the ancestors. Space does too, not just land. It carries the echoes of the people who've walked through this space before. And feeling that, understanding that, makes the life totally different. It's not meaningless anymore. And spaces should be like the indigenous culture's value of the land. I value space as well, the emptiness. And when one understands that, whether it's meditation or life, you know, it means that you're not so afraid of the end of things, the beginning of your life, the end of things. Why should there be a beginning or an end? Like I was mentioning in time, time being curved, life being curved as well. No beginning, no end. Yeah, bodies come and go, but life is something much different than the body. Life is just what does interact with space, and space with your life. And if we could only respect space much more, maybe we'd have much richer lives. Respecting, why is it that, you know, you go off into the bush, you go off by the ocean. You know, one of the beautiful things in Western Australia, you've got this ocean, and you look out over the ocean. The most beautiful part of it, there's nothing there. If you see a ship, you know, a great tanker or something, it spoils the emptiness, spoils the space, there's something there. When you see nothing for miles as far as the horizon, there's something very moving about that. So this is actually reflecting and understanding and really loving the idea of space, which connects us and which we, in which we leave an imprint, in which we change space. Even changing space for the better. So when you look at your house, don't just look at the stuff in your house, look at the space and worship it. When you go out into the community, don't just see how many cars there are on the freeway. There's many, but there's also much spaces as well. See the space and value the space, and you don't feel so cluttered. Give more space, you know, in your daily schedule, and also please give more space in your heart for people. Sometimes we think we can't get many more people into our hearts. Of course you can. Now, one of the meditations I developed years ago was imagining, you know, when you start meditating, closing your eyes, you imagine a circle. Inside that circle, all the people you like and love and care for. Just on the edge of the circle, there's all the people, yeah, they're okay, you don't really like them that much, but you don't hate them either, they're just, you know, ordinary people. They're not in your inner circle. And the further you go away from the centre of the circle, the more you put the people you don't like to way beyond the inner circle, the people you really hate, despise, the people who just really hurt you or hurt other people. You know, the paedophiles, you know, the torturers, all those people way up there. And in this little meditation, when you just arrange the people and events in this world, the things and people you like in the center, and the further you get away from the center, the more you dislike them, then you expand your circle. Give it more space to allow more people in, and more things you don't like in. Until the people who you're neutral to, actually you quite like them, you bring them in. And you keep expanding your circle and expanding it and expanding it until you have space for the whole universe with all its people, the really terrible people and the beautiful people, they can all find space in your heart too. That's a sign of an enlightened being. It doesn't reject anybody, but understands them. Why people do bad things, I can't understand, only they know. Sometimes they don't know, actually they don't know for sure. Being in the wrong place at the wrong time, drunk, stupid, whatever it was. But there's so much more to that. There's such more, much greater. Whoever's hurt you, whoever's your enemy, don't judge them so unfairly. There's far more to them than that. How many of you have been judged? Many of you are the enemy of others. Some people just don't like you. What's wrong with you? Nothing. You're okay. But still, you become the enemy of others. So the only way to overcome that is just to see much more. See the other side of you. If only the people who think you're an enemy, who don't like you, could see the real you, the whole you, all of you, then they would not reject you anymore. And the same as you, you can do the same for others. Until we have such a huge heart that we can actually expand it to include everybody. Have more space in your heart for others. Have more space in your heart for the pain of life. So that's important, that's where we learn from. That's where actually we learn things like compassion and kindness and wisdom. It's part of life. Have more space in your heart for people who do strange and weird things. That poor young man who came in during the meditation. Have space in the heart. And so when we understand the importance of space, space in the heart, space in our day, just to relax and be, space in our schedule, when we realize that doing nothing is important. So you schedule that in, the doing nothing time every day. Space. And then we can understand just how important space is in the spiritual world, in your life. So please, give yourself space. Value space. Cherish space. And then you'll have a wonderful life. Thank you. Okay, so I'm just talking, meandering on space. My journey into inner and outer and all sorts of space. Okay, so now we've got some questions. I hope we have a question from outer space today. Somebody's signing in from Mars. But any questions from the audience here about what I was talking about this evening? Spacing out.
Does the mind fill space?
Does
the mind fill space?
Mind fills space, exactly. That's one of the deep meditations, getting into the realm of infinite, unbounded space. So space out. So have the questions? Thank you. Only one. Amos from Mars. No, he's from USA. This is a big question in my life, the balance between solitude and connection. Also, the world's population is increasing very quickly. Many people have to live in close quarters. Any thoughts on how we can meet human needs for space as the world gets smaller? Second question first, world's population is increasing very quickly. We have to live in close quarters. Any thoughts on how we can meet human needs for space as the world gets smaller? Yes, we should have compulsory becoming monks and nuns. And then if more people become monks and nuns because we're celibate, we don't have kids, we mean the population will go down, we'll have more space for everybody. So, you know, you should be valuing us for not having any kids. So we need to sponsor a monk or sponsor a nun campaign to lessen the human world population to have more space. But being serious, you know, even though there's a huge world population, why is it that we all tend to stick together and cluster, you know, all together? And there is plenty of space, but we actually deny that space. We avoid that space. We're afraid of that space. And sometimes when we cherish the space, it's there for us. And even in a house, you know, we're close together, but there's still an incredible amount of space. If you look for it, it's there. So many, many people, they go to the CBD for shopping or for New Year's Eve. And there's other places which are empty. Why not celebrate New Year's Eve by the beach instead of by Northbridge? Why don't go for your holidays to the bush instead of to Paris, which is very crowded? Why is it that people always want to be where other people are? Always notice, because I used to live in a hut on the hill in Serpentine, and you could see the Southwest Highway. When it became a long weekend, you could see all the cars going south. And when it came to Sunday evening, all the cars going back again. So what do you go south for? They went south to get away from it all. But everyone else was going down south. If you'd have been smart, you'd have stayed at home and you'd get away from it all. So, and what I'm saying in this talk, there is a possibility. There's lots of solitude around. There's lots of space around. But take it, grasp it. But the most important question here is the balance between solitude and connection. And of course, there's no such thing as real solitude, because even when you're by yourself, you are connected to yourself. It's learning how to connect to yourself. I gave a talk over in Singapore, based on the Wisdom 101 conference in Silicon Valley, where one of our committee members went to. And it was titled Disconnect to Connect. Disconnect from your mobile phones to connect with life and connect with yourself. And I did mention that all those mobile devices, what are they called? iPhones, iPads, iPods. It's all about I. So I'm going to go to Google next month. I'm going to ask them to please rebrand them UzPods. Wii phones. So if you actually see that happening, you know where it came from. Why invent these silly ideas? But wouldn't it be wonderful, instead of calling it an iPhone, all about me, and then we don't connect with anybody. If it's a U phone or a Wii phone, just give it that different title, then suddenly we realize it's actually used to connect between people, rather than just me. So the balance between solitude and connection, even when you're alone, if you really know what being alone is, you connect with yourself and you're kind to yourself. You're giving yourself space, you're giving yourself time. It's really important to spend time by yourself. And if you love yourself and care for yourself, you're never lonely. I always say the difference between loneliness and solitude is whether you like yourself or not. As a monk, I spent long periods of time in solitude, but I never felt lonely. Because when I was in solitude, I spent, 6 months without seeing another human being or talking to anybody. 6 whole months in total solitude. But I was never, ever lonely, not once, because I was always with my best friend. And that was me. I am my best friend. But I also can have space in my life for other friends as well. So solitude is where you learn how to be your best friend. And when you're connecting with others, you realize just like you, just like others, they can be your friends too. So when I'm alone, I put this beautiful kindness, friendship between me and myself in that space. When I learn to do that myself, then I can do it so easy with other people. So basically, there is no difference between solitude and connection. In solitude, you're connected to yourself. And then with society, you're connecting with others. You put the same thing in the space. So that's it. Okay, so I hope you enjoyed that talk tonight. Just a strange talk, new subject. Just spreading around the spirituality of space. Da da da. Okay.
Somebody left their wallet around, so if they can see me after.
Okay. Is there any space in the wallet? Oh, is there money in there? In most people's wallets this time of the year, it's full of space. They spent too much. Okay, let's pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and then we can go.
Arahant Sammasambuddho Bhagava Buddhaṃ Bhagavantaṃ Abhivadami. Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savakasangho Sanghang Namami